Hello, I'm Nick Craft. I'm the director of the ESRC Research Centre CAGE at Warwick. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Lord Skidelsky, and we're going to discuss various aspects of the current economic crisis. So, Robert, first of all, I think it would be commonly agreed that we've been through the biggest financial and economic crisis for the West, at least, since the 1930s.
I agree.
Why do you think that's happened? Well, what are the fundamental reasons we've had such a hard time?
Well, obviously, something went seriously wrong with the financial system and it imploded. Partly that was because it had been excessively deregulated. Partly, I think, it was because bankers were working to a model of the financial system which excluded the possibility of large-scale collapses of this kind. They thought that their risks were well judged. They ignored the fact that their individual bets might suddenly be correlated in a disastrous way. They ignored the possibility of systemic risk. And in other words, they suffered from hubris. They simply thought they were gods and they could get away with anything. I think that another fact, of course, was that they developed financial instruments which they didn't understand. They didn't understand their toxic possibilities. So I think all these things came together.
Does globalization make that worse?
Yes, I think so, because the contagion spreads more quickly from one affected bank to another. After all, it all really started with a subprime mortgage market in the United States, and that shouldn't really have affected the world's banking system, but through the mechanism of credit default swap, a lot of banks all over the world ended up holding this debt, which turned out to be useless at the moment when they needed it not to be.
So regulators were at fault?
I think regulators were at fault, and this comes out very strongly in what Adair Turner said very soon after the crisis started and what he's been saying ever since, that the regulators were working to a wrong model of the economy, or a wrong model of the financial system, more accurately, in which these big shocks were excluded by assumption, and therefore only lightest touch regulation was needed.
So financial regulators have got it wrong. Did central bankers get it wrong as well?
Well, that's always been alleged of Alan Greenspan in the United States, that he kept money too cheap for too long. But he's got a defence, which is that had he not kept money very, very cheap, then the excess savings of China would have actually caused the world a recession sooner. He kept the American economy going by very cheap money. But I think this is where the Keynesian model comes in, because there weren't really any very good investment opportunities in the United States. A lot of this money was borrowed for consumption, not for investment. And that was unsustainable in the end, because people were accumulating debts that they weren't able to repay.
That leads me in a way to some follow-up question of the kind, did economists get it wrong?
That's a more controversial question, because I think it depends what you think the dominant macro theory was and also what the dominant financial theories were. I do think that economic ideas have an influence on events, and in this I follow John Maynard Keynes, who said in the end it's the ideas of the economists and philosophers that matter more than vested interests. I think in the States particularly, macroeconomics was dominated by a new classical economics, and I think this was always vastly overblown. A theory of economic behavior. I think in the microeconomic area, the efficient market hypothesis for financial markets was also wildly unrealistic. It assumed, I think, that shares were always correctly valued, which meant that risks were always correctly valued. Alan Greenspan said after the crisis there was a worldwide underpricing of risks. The whole intellectual system on which I'd been relying was flawed. Well, that's quite important testimony. Of course, the people, the mandarins of the Chicago School, don't admit to any fault at all, but they have been rather quiet over the period of the crisis.
Although it's been a bad crisis, we use the phrase perhaps Great Recession. Whereas in the 1930s, we talk of Great Depression. This didn't get as far, or at least it hasn't at the moment, got as far as becoming a Great Depression. Does that imply that policymakers did something relatively successful or made a reasonably good response when the crisis erupted, even though perhaps they were at fault in allowing the crisis to emerge?
I think they did. I think that the stimulus packages put in place in both October 2008 and March 2009, in a global and coordinated way, actually prevented a slide down into another Great Depression. I think if you look at the data, between 1929 and 1931, there were, I think, was it 12 or 13 successive quarters of decline. In 2008-9, there were only five. In fact, the declines were absolutely as steep in both cases, and then the last decline was cut off. And if you ask why it was cut off, I think it was the policy was different. I think there was a big stimulus, not only in the West, but also in China. And that maintained demand sufficiently to prevent things getting a lot worse. But once they'd sort of flattened it out, then they sort of lost interest almost, except in the United States and China, but certainly in the UK and Europe. They lost interest in maintaining the stimulus, and the whole emphasis then switched to austerity and the threat to the finances of governments. And of course, if you do counteract the big decline in spending in the private sector by increasing government spending, of course you get into what's called unsound fiscal positions.
This seems to give slightly better press to economics than the crisis emerging in the first place. Are you partly saying that we did learn lessons from that 1930s experience, that even if Keynes has been occasionally set aside, nevertheless there's a deep-rooted Keynesian response when things get really bad?
I think what he left was an instinct. I'm not sure that people really were working. In their response, they had a sort of well-worked-out Keynesian model of aggregate demand and the amounts you needed to put into the economy. I think they just realized that it was too great a risk to take to allow things to get really bad. And that was a lesson of the 30s. It wasn't necessarily a Keynesian lesson, it was a lesson of the politics of the 30s.
Though it would be fair to say that people like Ben Bernanke, Christy Romer,
yes,
quite distinguished scholars of the 30s who probably do have a fairly strong view as to what went wrong then.
They did. Ben was particularly influenced by Milton Friedman and his monetary theory of the Great Depression and acted on it. And that's one of the unresolved questions in political economy today, which is how effective monetary easing is. I think Keynes always said you can't pull on a string. It's not enough to get an economy really booming again. And I think we're going to get a bit of a test of that in the United States. I mean, I think it has been moderately effective in the United States, but some studies I've seen suggest that the effects are quite small. I think one of the tests of that is what happens to the velocity of circulation. You can pump money in, but it's got to be spent. And it's got to be spent in ways that increase employment and output. And if it's not, then you can pump and pump and pump, but if either the banks are busy delevering or if demand confidence is shot in investment, then the money doesn't really get into circulation in the way that I think the monetarists would claim it does.
If we think of how particularly the United States eventually started to recover in the 1930s, it's always seemed to me that what happened to real interest rates was quite important.
Yeah, yeah.
And that changing inflationary expectations was part of the solution to the problem that you've just been alluding to.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that's right?
Yes. I mean, what happened?
And leaving the gold standard, of course, was fairly
leaving
central.
The gold standard was central, absolutely. I think that was key. It was also very, very important in Britain's recovery. But whether the effect was through interest rates or actually the change in the value of the currency, I'm not sure. Undoubtedly, it gave a fillip to exports in the British case, but that didn't last very long. And what it led to, in my reading of things anyway, is a couple of years later, the United States went off gold as well. And so that temporary export advantage was gone, but nevertheless, it was stimulating while it lasted. The other thing you have to add to the British thing, of course, is cheap money and conversion of the war debt, cheaper forms. And the third element is protection. How the credit for recovery is divided between these three factors. I'm not absolutely sure. I don't know whether economic historians have reached a consensus on this. But in any case, the recovery wasn't complete. And it wasn't complete in the United States either. And there was a big collapse again in 1937-38. And the only country that did actually lick unemployment was Hitler's Germany.
Food for thought there in terms of the escape route for example, the citizens of Greece at the moment.
Yeah.
Let me just, if I may, turn to that very nasty recession that the United States had in 1937-38. I suppose in modern parlance we might call it a double dip.
Yes.
It was big. Real GDP fell by something like 8% in a year.
Yeah.
Why did that happen?
I never really ever studied the 37-38 recession or double dip. I assumed it happened because the stimulus was withdrawn prematurely. That's the story I've been fed, and I haven't challenged it because I haven't studied any alternative accounts. I'm sure there are alternative accounts, but that's the one I was brought up with.
No, I think that's basically right. I think there are two things. Firstly, an attempt to go back to a balanced budget, and secondly, monetary tightening. Both monetary and fiscal shock. What I was driving on to, as you can probably guess, is where we are now in terms of post-crisis, but only at the very beginning of recovery. What do you think that experience, and perhaps economics more generally as you understand it, tells us about the right trajectory for, say, the British government's policy in trying to consolidate recovery? What should it be doing? Is it doing the right things?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's nothing in economic theory that tells you that you should have a timetable for fiscal tightening or fiscal loosening, for that matter. It should depend actually on the circumstances you find yourself in. And I think that's what they should have said from the start. But the last government, I'm afraid, slightly sold the pass by having its five-year program, and this government's just tightened it a bit. So I think that was wrong. I think this government in particular has been working on a theory for which there's almost no theoretical and even less empirical justification, which is the theory of expansionary fiscal tightening. In other words, Ricardian equivalence. I think that is the theoretical basis of their fiscal contraction. That is, if they reduce their debt, then private sector will start spending more because they won't be expecting to pay taxes in the future. I think where economists, economic historians, but again, there may be others, have studied these episodes. I think there was an Irish episode earlier on. There was a Swedish episode. There were a number of episodes of fiscal tightening which seemed successful. And what they concluded was that fiscal tightening is not inconsistent with economic recovery, provided it's accompanied by monetary loosening or devaluation. But then you shouldn't attribute the success to the fiscal tightening, but to these other measures. Now, it may be that the fiscal tightening enabled some of these monetary things.
I think you're right that the standard story in the literature is successful fiscal consolidations, which don't harm growth, usually involve monetary loosening at the same time.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's quite difficult with interest rates as low as they are now.
Yes, no, it is. Because you are sort of entering a liquidity trap areas where it may be that the rate of interest, which is really required to stimulate investment, is lower than you can push interest rates.
Does that get back to the point that we need to work on real interest rates?
It does. You could try and work on real interest rates. I suppose if a monetary loosening did the job it's supposed to do and pushed up prices, then you could get real interest rates down. Mm. But I'm not sure it does. I think the monetary loosening would have to be much, much, much greater than anyone is really contemplating in order to get real interests down sufficiently to revive private investment. I don't know. It varies from country to country.
I suppose the government would probably say there's a point at which the debt gets large enough that markets worry about your ability or your willingness, if you wish, to continue to behave responsibly. And interest rates start to reflect those risks. And in some sense, the situation spirals out of control. You're saying that's not really an immediate danger?
Not for the UK or the States. I think it was a danger in Greece, but then we're not Greece. Greece has actually been, this is one of the things Reinhardt and Rogoff pointed out in their book. I remember the table, it's on page 99 if anyone's interested, that Greece has been in default for half the time it's been independent. That is ever since 1824. Well, they define default rather loosely, but even so, Greece was always going to be a bigger risk than Britain. And in fact, the British government has been able to borrow, go on borrowing quite cheaply, the United States government as well. Why? Now, George Osborne would say, well, this is because of our robust fiscal stance, and we've shown we can actually get the situation under control. But it may be it's because there's an aversion to risk now, and people don't know where else to put their money. So of all the risky assets, government debt may still be regarded as less risky than some of the others, the least risky. So again, there's a lot here that I think economic historians will be able to tell us in future, which we can't really say anything very conclusive about now because we're in the middle of a flow. It's when we get to the end and we see some of the outcomes that I think we'll really be able to sort some of this out.
Are you basically optimistic, pessimistic, or just deeply uncertain about what happens to the British economy over the next 2 or 3 years as this coalition strategy of debt and deficit reduction takes hold?
There is a possibility of a double dip, and the last quarter's figures, even though the snow may have interfered with them, are not a pristine example of a vigorous recovery. You'll have to look at several quarters in a row to know exactly what might happen. But I think there's been a big misinterpretation of Keynes in this. Keynes did not believe that an economy slumped and then stayed in the same position for year after year. That's not what he meant by underemployment equilibrium. He said, quite rightly, that economies always recover from shocks by natural mechanisms. But the recoveries would not, if you relied only on natural mechanisms, be strong enough to carry them back to anything like full employment. That's what he said. And that was his argument for an exogenous stimulus. And I think that's what's going to happen. I think we will start growing again, but it'll be feeble. It'll be a lower growth rate than the one which preceded the slump. And it'll leave a lot of unemployed. It'll leave a lot of long-term unemployed, spare capacity that will be destroyed because it won't be being used. And what emerges at the end of the day, the new normal, as one analyst called it, the new normal will be less good than the old normal. And I think that that is what the policy of the coalition is leading to. Now, if you look at the world picture, this wrong policy could be offset. Britain is a small enough economy now to be highly influenced by what happens in other parts of the world. If Obama adopts a different stance and gets the American economy growing more vigorously, if China's growth rate continues, in other words, if the non-Western world booms, then Britain will benefit and Europe will benefit too. But Europe, apart from Germany, the demand is very flat, growth prospects are poor. So you're not going to get much benefit from exporting to Euroland, which now takes 50% of British exports. So I would say, you know, mediocre recovery, and one which will expose lots of economic problems on the way, including, as I said, most importantly, long-term unemployment.
So it seems to me you'd probably quite like to send George Osborne to a desert island.
I certainly would. I think
which particular volume of Keynes should he take with him so that he comes back a better person?
I think he should take the most difficult one, which is volume 2, which actually tries to chart the development of Keynes's theory from the time when he was critical of the gold standard through his whole monetarist phase to the general theory and the aggregate demand Keynes. And I think he would find much food for thought. I think it would be a tremendous boost to his economic education, which I think is rather meagre. I think he'd have benefited enormously, Nick, from having taken some courses with you too on economic history. You know, I think he lacks historical knowledge. He lacks even a feel, I think, for a humane economics. And his calculations are political. Well, I think they'll turn out to be wrong.
Thank you very much, Lord Skidelsby, for joining me here today at the University of Warwick.
It's been a great pleasure.